Good morning, and welcome to Talk Louisiana. Coming today, we'll visit with Jim Henderson. He is the president of the University of Louisiana system, and Dr. Henderson will discuss what's going on with higher education. Yesterday, the House finally came to grips with a third of a penny renewal of a sales tax, and what will this do as far as funding the gap that still exists for the fiscal cliff that comes in a month. Also on the show today, we'll visit with Amanda Rabelais and with Sadie Wilkes from the Manship School. They're here to talk about the Bateman competition success for one of LSU's fine entities. And we'll hear from Carl Zimmer, the New York Times science reporter. Carl Zimmer on the power of heredity in our lives. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on WRKF, 877-217-5757. That's your number. If you're in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, you can email us, talk at talklouisiana.org. We start with Jim Henderson, president of the University of Louisiana system, one of the nation's largest higher education systems, nine universities, 91,500 students are in the system at the nine campuses in our state. And Jim Henderson, of course, is following what's going on at the Capitol because it affects higher education immensely. And yesterday, the Louisiana legislature hit the midway point of the second special session. After multiple unsuccessful attempts in the House, the lower chamber agreed to advance revenue-raising bills to soften the fiscal cliff. One-third of the tax, the temporary tax, would be expanded under the House edict, 76 to 26, to generate about $370 million. That does not, of course, cover the projected shortfall of about $650 million. So there would be a hole, and of course, the Senate will go to work, and we'll see what happens. But it was a step forward. Nonetheless, if it stays at this level, I would imagine, Jim Henderson, you'll have some work to do. Colleges will be facing more cuts.
Well, that is the worry, of course. I will tell you, yesterday and this weekend, I saw a lot of collaboration, a lot of bipartisanship. That's what led to the success yesterday. Of course, the renewal of one-third of the tax that is going off of the books July 1st received 76 votes in the legislature, which is a good sign that people are beginning to understand the scope of the challenge and really working together to fund many of the state's priorities, including talent development for colleges and universities.
Well, for those unfamiliar, Jim's been with us before, but the University of Louisiana system involves the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, the University of Louisiana Monroe, University of New Orleans, as well as Northwestern State, Southeastern, Nichols, McNeese, Grambling, and Louisiana Tech. And congratulations, by the way, to the Northwestern State Demons, who are headed to Corvallis, Oregon, along with the LSU Fighting Tigers, to play in the NCAA Baseball Regional at Oregon State University. Oh. They'll be the host team. And you're a 1994 journalism graduate of Northwestern State University.
That's right, and I'm so proud of Bobby Barbier, the head coach and a graduate of Northwestern State. He was an academic All-American when he played baseball for Northwestern. And it's great that they're in the same bracket with LSU. Mostly, I think, on opening night, it's not official yet, but I call it a purple out. Everyone should be wearing their purple. And I will tell you, if you're planning to drive to Corvallis, Google Maps says it's about a 38-hour drive. There is a little fender bender north of Provo, Utah, that you want to look out for. But otherwise, it's a clear shot.
All right. Well, and I'm sure many know that Coach O, LSU's football coach, began his college odyssey at LSU and then went to Northwestern State, played under Sam Goodwin, and had quite a career with the Purple Demons.
You know, he was on a team with Bobby Hebert, with Mark Duper, All-Pro Hall of Famer from Miami Dolphins, and, of course, the greatest demon of all time, Joe Delaney, who was, All-Pro for the Kansas City Chiefs and then died in heroically saving some kids from drowning up in the Monroe area. So a lot of history to Northwestern sports.
He probably just missed Gary Reasons, who he's a Pro Football Hall of Famer, isn't he?
He just missed Gary Reasons, and of course Gary still has the greatest goal line tackle of all time when he just came flying over the line in the snow and just level. Every time I watch it, I still wince.
Well, Jim Henderson was president of Northwestern State University. President or chancellor?
I was president. In Louisiana, we do things a little bit different than most other states. In most states, they have chancellors of systems and presidents. of universities, we typically have presidents of systems and chancellors of universities, mm-hmm. except in UL system, where we have a president of a system and presidents of universities. Okay, makes it real clear for people.
So you're president of Northwestern, your alma mater, and you've been on college campuses when things were uncertain. How does that affect the faculty and the student body when you don't know where things are going?
You know, the student body, it's a little bit different because they're somewhat insulated from talks of budget cuts in general. Of course, they bear the brunt of the cuts, but they're focused on studies. They're focused on the things that most traditional young people are focused on. Faculty are the ones that really are the ones that get weary. You know, we're not competitive with the rest of the southern states in faculty salaries. We fall well behind, and it's because our universities operate at the lowest resource base per student in the nation. Now, you can say that as a complaint. We say it would have been a bit of pride, you know, operating right at the lowest unit cost in the country. We still managed to achieve our highest enrollment in 5 years. We are graduating at a 10% higher graduation rate than ever before. So our faculty have done some amazing work. It's time, though, that we reinvest in their work and reinvest in talent development in general.
I mentioned going into our conversation that the system has over 91,000 students. Some may find it surprising that only 28,000, but 28,000 is, of course, a big number, but it's about, less than a third of the total number of students. They're on TOPS in the University of Louisiana system. And TOPS, if things don't get changed at the Capitol, it may very well be cut. They've got to do better than one-third of a penny to sustain TOPS, I would think. So what does this do as far as potentially affecting enrollment, morale, and you name it? It would seem that it would not be a good thing.
Well, you know, the last expressed will of the legislature was the passage of HB 1 in the regular session that cut TOPS by 30%. So essentially what we're telling is a third of the students that attend UL system institutions that even though they have upheld their end of the bargain, they have achieved all of the performance metrics given to them by the state of Louisiana, that we're going to force them to come up with $1,500 out of pocket in addition to about the $3,000 out of pocket they already pay for higher education in order to continue their schooling. Now, a third of those students are Pell students. They're already in the lowest income brackets. Most of them are first-generation students. And while $1,500 may not sound like a mm-hmm. lot to adults or middle-class Louisianans, it's quite a barrier to some of these students who are literally a dead car battery away from dropping out of school. So it puts them in angst. It puts them in uncertainty. We've got this graduating class of one of the highest-ranking graduating classes from Louisiana high schools this year. They're being inundated with offers from out-of-state schools, and now the state is saying, you know, we're not sure if we're going to fulfill the TOPS promise. That's a bad place for them to be.
877-217-5757 for Jim Henderson, president of the University of Louisiana system. And also, if you'd like to send an email, you can do so, talk@talklouisiana.org. And nine universities are under his jurisdiction. The University of New Orleans was the most recent entry into the UL system, and it used to be part of the LSU system, and a listener asked, how's it going with UNO now part of your group?
You know, it's been I've spent a little bit of time on UNO's campus, especially over this last year. It's a beautiful campus right there on the shores of Lake Pontchartrain in a city that is really the definition of resurgence. We just had the great announcement of DXC Technology bringing 2,500-plus direct jobs to the Central Business District of New Orleans. UNO will be a major player than that. I can tell you that their requests for enrollment and admissions are way up for this coming year. I think they're working hard on establishing their identity and what their role is in that market. I'm very bullish on the future of UNO.
Which university has the highest enrollment?
University of Louisiana at Lafayette is right at 19,000 students.
But above 15,000, you have several of the others.
We have ULL, we have Southeastern Louisiana University, and, of course, Louisiana Tech is right there close to 15,000 students in the Piney Woods.
And UNO is?
UNO is down at 8,000 students.
It's down to 8,000.
Before Katrina, it had reached a peak of about 16,000 students. We believe that their number should be around 12,000 students. That's when we know they're effectively serving that market.
And the University of Louisiana system services 91,000 students. That's a huge number in a state with 4.7 million people. If my math is right, that means that 2% of all the people in the state are going to one of these schools.
Well, it's a large number of students, but when you look at where we are in terms of educational attainment, Louisiana ranks anywhere between 46th and 50th, depending on the measure, in educational attainment. And when you juxtapose that to the demands of the 21st century economy, we know that colleges, that advanced knowledge and college education are going to be ever more critical to making a workforce competitive. In fact, after the last recession, the first 2.9 million jobs that were created, 2.8 million of those jobs went to those with bachelor's degrees. It's no longer a luxury. It is absolutely a necessity if you're going to be successful in the 21st century job market.
Well, you have been down at the Capitol, and last week there was Higher Ed Day at the Capitol, and you see these lawmakers in action. Do they have a sense of urgency? Do you think that they're really concerned about the fiscal cliff now being a month and a day away, or are they dilly-dallying around?
I was very pleased to see the progress that they made yesterday in advancing the renewal of one-third of the one-penny sales tax that's going off the books July 1st. To me, it says that they are understanding the urgency that is before us. You know, it's not just a cut to tops. We have a $96 million cut that is on the books right now for colleges and universities. And remember, these are colleges and universities that already operate at the lowest unit cost in the nation, lowest resource base per student. Continuing to disinvest is going to do a disservice to our employers, to our faculty, and to our students.
One lawmaker said they were acting susciently, right?
I love the language you can hear at the Capitol. I'm going to use susciently in a lot of work going forward.
Was that Lance Harris?
he did a great job carrying his
belt. Well, it's actually a pretty good word, marked by blithe unconcern and nonchalance.
That
pretty much describes it, doesn't
right.
it? 877-217-5757. We're back after this timeout with more from Jim Henderson on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Jim Henderson, president of the University of Louisiana System, is with us for a little while longer. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 297-5633 in Baton Rouge, elsewhere, anywhere, 877-217-5757. As far as TOPS, do you think that's a program that is worth sustaining?
You know, I think TOPS is one of the best investments we have ever made in development of our youth, the development of and achievement of educational attainment. You can debate the merits of TOPS, whether it's if the criteria are rigorous enough, whether there's a new way to target the investment in TOPS, and I think they've had a lot of those conversations. But fulfilling the TOPS promise for those who are already TOPS recipients is absolutely essential. To default on that promise is unconscionable.
877-217-5757, Barry in Mid-City. Hi, Barry. We haven't heard from, I think this is Rabbi Weinstein in a while. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and I really appreciate your show and your guest. I am concerned that the legislature doesn't really understand the importance of higher education and what, to me, seems like an easy puzzle to solve in terms of the tax renewal and moving forward. I wonder if Dr. Henderson could address the thinking of the people in the legislature, or are they totally concerned with getting reelected?
Well, thank you very much for the question. I think the vast majority of legislators really have the best interest of the state at heart. Now, they can have a different opinion or a different ideology in how to best achieve what those best interests are. And we spend a lot of our time educating legislators on the value of higher education. In fact, all nine of our university presidents will be in town today. We'll have a luncheon with several legislators. We'll have a lot of one-on-one conversations talking about the return on investment of our work, the economic impact of our work, the value of recruiting, retaining, and developing our faculty who are so essential, not just in educating students, but the impact that these faculty make and the quality of life and the culture of our communities. And when you take the whole of higher education, I think you're right. It is a no-brainer that it's worthy of our investment. And so it's incumbent upon us to carry that message to them in a way that they can grasp and make wise decisions for investments in our future.
Most of the people in the state are not college graduates.
That's right.
Many never went to college. Some believe that college, in most cases, is unnecessary, that it burdens students with debt, that it doesn't get them where they need to be, and It basically keeps them from facing reality for a while. How do you answer those critics?
And that's my biggest worry, because our own personal experiences shape our opinions, shape our belief systems, and everybody knows a success story. Somebody who didn't go to college, who is just through work ethic and common sense has been tremendously successful.
Like Rush Limbaugh.
Of course. And construction industry is loaded. My own father-in-law didn't speak English until he started wearing shoes in third grade from Gaydon, Louisiana.
There you go.
One of the most successful contractors I've known. But here's the thing. As with advances in technology, with the ubiquity of automation, with the emergence of artificial intelligence, those opportunities are going by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
And more employers over the next decade are going to be looking for those who can think critically, who can solve problems, who can communicate effectively. And the best way to develop those core competencies, the best way we've ever invented, is through a college education. That's what's going to make a person competitive in the job market. It's what's going to make our employers competitive as they compete across global markets. It's what's going to drive quality of life in our communities. I think colleges and universities are the wisest investment for our future.
I do have a note here from a listener, Sherry, saying that Rush Hudson Limbaugh III did go to college. He went to Southeast Missouri State University.
Oh, there you go.
But he did not graduate. Neither did Sean Hannity, by the way, and neither did Brian Williams at MSNBC. A lot of journalism icons didn't graduate from college. You graduated from the great journalism school at Natchitoches. I'm a graduate of LSU's journalism school. But how important is a degree? And is there importance in just having the college experience, even if you don't get a degree?
You know, our universities are ranked very high across the nation. And just for those who have been exposed to that college experience, seeing upward social mobility, moving up quintiles in socioeconomic status. But to me, the degree is important. And it's being used more and more by employers as an entry-level credential. And I'll give you an example. Just look at executive assistants. And think of how their work has changed. It's not just typing into Rolodexes, but it's making critical decisions. It's communicating with people on the phone. So 60% of executive assistants that exist today are 20% of executive assistants that exist today have a college degree. On those jobs that are currently on the market across the nation, 65% have a college degree as an entry-level credential. You cannot even get a job interview without a college degree. And so that's going to become the new norm. As technology continues to advance, you have to have advanced skills. You're going to have to add value to organizations, and the college degree is the best preparation for that.
All right, here's another question from a listener that reflects the times. This one from Holly in the Garden District about online education. Mm-hmm. Are you taking advantage of that in the University of Louisiana system?
We actually are. In fact, we have several of our schools have robust online offerings. I have done a lot of online learning myself. I teach an online class for Northwestern and a Doctorate of Education program, for example. Online education, bringing education to adults. And you're going to see the University of Louisiana system launch a very comprehensive outreach program. So we can take these adult populations, those that have some college but no degree, and help them find a fast, affordable way to a quality education that is relevant in today's job market. I think it's going to be essential that we find ways to reach out to that adult population, 1.5 million of which in Louisiana don't have a college credential at all. If they want to participate in the job market, they're going to have to develop those skills over the course of a lifetime.
Stuart in South Baton Rouge. Hi, Stuart. You're on the air on Talk Louisiana with Jim Henderson.
Hey, Stuart.
Well, thank you. Good morning, gentlemen, and to your audience. Dr. Henderson, will you share with us the percentage of Louisiana graduates who leave the state post-graduation, if not immediately, within 5 years, if you have that stat or those stats? And secondly, and you may not be able to answer this, what is Louisiana doing to attract more Fortune 500 companies and more corporations who are capable of employing these graduates who strap themselves in massive debt in many instances? What are we going to do? I just heard you quote that in the next 10 years, are you going to need a college education because of artificial intelligence and the way society is moving? But how is that going to benefit the state of Louisiana?
All right.
Well, I think those are some great questions. I don't have all the statistics. I will tell you that the most recent statistics of employment that I've seen showed the graduates from the last 4 years of the University of Louisiana system, 74% are found to be employed in Louisiana today. So that's a good number. And is this something we want to work on? Sure. Part of that is creating these opportunities. And I think you alluded to that, saying, what is Louisiana doing to lure these companies to our state? And I'll give you a couple examples. One of them is the DXC announcement in New Orleans, where the reason that DXC decided amongst numerous states, numerous communities to come to New Orleans is because of the close working relationship they saw amongst the higher ed community. All four systems were at the table to bring these folks in, demonstrating to them our talent development capabilities and our ability to work with employers to develop that pipeline. It's very similar to what we did in North Louisiana on I-20, which is quickly becoming the technology corridor of the nation, and it's kind of an unknown entity, especially for folks in South Louisiana, where you have Louisiana Tech as the hub, working with Bossier Parish Community College, working with UL Monroe, Northwestern State. You've got CenturyLink on one side of the state. You've got General Dynamics in the Cyber Research Park in North Louisiana. And the energy that is coming from that region, with more and more employers coming to that area, bringing high-tech jobs, jobs of the future, and it's all based on that talent development part of the equation. I'm very excited about what's going on in North Louisiana.
When all is said and done 6 days from now, when the special session, the second one, closes, what do you think? Everything's going to be hunky-dory?
Well, I hope so. I'm the eternal delusional optimist, to steal a line from some of my friends on a local sports blog. But, you know, it's a very simple solution. They just have to find the right level of revenue that they can live with, but ensure that we are sustaining the investment in colleges and universities and we're fulfilling the TOPS promise. If we do those two things, the talent development enterprise we unleash on the state will give us a competitive advantage for the foreseeable future.
Well, good luck, Jim Henderson. Hey, it's always good to visit with you. Thanks for stopping in this morning. One of the best-dressed people at the Capitol as well. So
my pleasure.
We'll return with some interesting people from the Manship School after this time out. Now the news with Karen Henderson on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana on WRKF 877-217-5757 is your number, and talk at talklouisiana.org is the email address. And before we get to our distinguished guest from the Manship School, I do want to note that yesterday we were talking with Dan Bornay about the unusual anniversary yesterday, the 100th birthday of John McKithen, the former governor, and the 200th birthday of P.G.T. Beauregard, who was a hero of a few wars and, of course, was a brigadier general in the Confederate States Army. His statue in New Orleans was taken down last year at the order of Mayor Mitch Landrieu and the city council. And there are many places in Louisiana named after General Beauregard, including Beauregard Parish and several other locations, and I noted them. And I also mentioned Beauregard Town here in Baton Rouge, and I was wrong. And I think Judy in Beauregard Town. It was actually named after a gentleman named Elias Beauregard, who was a city planner back in the early part of the 19th century. So Beauregard Town was not named after P.G.T. Beauregard. In studio now, and thank you, Judy, is Sadie Wilkes, Manship School instructor and advisor, and Amanda Rabelais, who is here as a recent graduate and part of the Bateman team competition. And we'll talk with her about this competition, as well as Sadie. And this is big stuff for public relations practitioners. And good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Jim.
And Amanda, I knew your dad well. He and I were college roommates back in the day.
Yeah, he
went on to really bigger and better things. One of the most prominent lawyers in Louisiana, Steve Rabelais, and an accomplished writer as well.
Yes, so yes. He has a biography on Fox Connor, General Fox Connor, out right now.
And has won several awards for it. So Steve is doing very well and has been a guest on this show. And it's good to have you as a guest for the first time of many, I'm sure. And Sadie, you're involved in this Bateman competition. Tell us how this works.
Well, the Bateman competition is sponsored by the Public Relations Student Society of America, and it's a way for our students to get some real work experience by working for a national client, along with 84 other teams across the nation. These college students take on developing and creating a public relations plan that they implement here at the local level.
And the campaign slogan this time around was?
The Fight for Five.
Fight for Five.
Right.
What does that stand for?
Well, we did some research, and according to that research, we found that 1 in 5 children who were diagnosed with pediatric cancer will not survive. So we wanted to create a campaign based around fighting for all 5 of those statistical children. So the Fight for 5 came about.
And I'm sure it was very well received.
Oh, pretty well, yeah.
Well, 84 universities compete in this, right?
That's right.
So how are the winners, if you will, or how are they chosen?
Well, public relations professionals deemed by Public Relations Society of America, as well as the With Purpose Board, they actually take a look at all of the campaigns, and they decide on the top 3. There are usually about 10 honorable mentions, but the top 3 are actually invited to the headquarters for the nonprofit to do a final pitch, and that's how they determine first, second, and third place.
And the LSU Manship School, to bury the lead.
Right.
You took home first place.
We did.
First out of 84 universities.
Yes, sir.
I imagine some big schools participated too, right?
Right. I'm not sure what the 84 made up, but you know that's at least probably an average of 1 and a little bit per state. So I'm guessing we had pretty good coverage across the nation as far as big states competing.
And you had 5 members on your team, right?
That's right.
Who were the others?
So the others were Josie Bonnet, Kevin Miner, Megan Morvant, and Chloe Kingston.
All public relations students?
Yes, all public relations seniors.
And when people think of a journalism school, often they think of print journalism or broadcast journalism. But LSU, like many schools, and for good reason, the Manship School, long before it was a Manship School, has always had an advertising and public relations component, which, of course, is part of journalism as well.
Right.
Why do students go into public relations as opposed to the other type of journalism?
Well, so the good thing about Manship is that it does have integrated communications. So a lot of the classes that public relations students are taking are the same classes that journalism students will take and advertising students will take. So as we go into this new age of communication, it's so important for students to have a holistic view of communications, and public relations, in my opinion, provides a great opportunity for understanding other people. You know, it could be your client, understanding your client's motivations, and thus creating better communications for the long run.
Now, doing this show, just this show, I have so many inquiries that if I were to provide an opportunity for everybody who would like to be on the air to talk about what they're doing, I wouldn't have time other than talking about events and things of that sort. And so we have to pick and choose. And so this is an important one. That's why I chose it. And you, through Stephanie Mallon at the Manship School, approached me, and I thought it was a worthy topic. But you had 2 million people who were exposed to this Fight for 5 campaign. How did you get that many people to become aware of it?
Well, we did it in a couple ways. First, we focused on social media outreach. And through social media, we posted a series of videos. One of those videos got over 10,000 views in 24 hours. So we had a crazy amount of reception
on
social media.
How did that happen?
Well, the video was called Featured Fighters, was what it was called. And
yeah,
it just showcased 6 individuals who were affected by pediatric cancer in some way. Either they were survivors themselves or had lost children or family members to pediatric cancer. And we just put their stories in a video and put it out to the world, and everyone just reacted so heavily to their stories that it took off.
And with people now skeptical about so-called fake news, is it difficult to have people take you seriously and to believe what is actually being presented to them?
A little bit, but we didn't really have that much of an issue with it, just based off of how we presented the video itself. We interviewed these people and, you know, had B-roll footage of a lot of their, it was, I guess, hard evidence of their stories. So it wasn't too tricky, especially just because our campaign was stated pretty clearly that this was for a competition, and people kind of knew we were students just trying our best.
Sadie, I assume that the Manship School has participated in this competition before.
We have participated. Last year we had a Bateman team. Before that, we had had a few years off, and then prior to that, we had competed in the Bateman competition off and on for as long as I can remember.
Is this first number one?
This is.
The first number one. The Bateman Case Study Competition is the Public Relations Student Society of America's contest for PR students and provides them with the opportunity to apply classroom education and internship experiences to create a full campaign for public relations. And this year, the Manship students developed campaigns on behalf of With Purpose, bringing awareness to the necessity of safe and effective treatment options for children with cancer in America. I imagine you've become somewhat of an authority on this.
A little bit, yeah. Spent a few months on it. You kind of become an expert in anything.
Worthy endeavor. That always helps. But now when you do a public relations campaign, you have to hit all kinds of media. You can't just pinpoint one to be
right.
effective, right?
Exactly.
Social media, is that a necessary component? Is that something that just has to be done now?
For our target audience, it was definitely a necessity. We were targeting Generation Z, which is the generation below mine, the ones
Generation
that are,
Z.
Yes, that's the
Where
ones.
Where does Generation Z start?
Generation Z, I'm pretty sure, starts in 1996.
People born 1996
to 2006,
and later.
2006, yes. So it's this generation that's in high school, just about to go into college, 18-year-olds who are just getting into their own ideals.
Well, Generation Z sounds like the end. That's the last letter of the
right.
alphabet.
Right. I'm like, what's coming after?
I noticed one of the advisors was Lindsay Rabelais.
That's right.
Your sister?
That's right, my sister. She is an adjunct professor at Manship teaching media law. So we figured, and she also has a public relations degree herself. So mm-hmm. we figured she would be a great asset to the team to kind of help us with the PR side. But also, she's been out of PR for a little bit. She's a practicing lawyer. So she kind of had an outside perspective while still being knowledgeable on the material.
Well, next week, Jerry Seppos, who has departed as the dean after 7 years of outstanding leadership, he will be with us and talk about journalism in general. And there is much to discuss. And, of course, Martin Henderson's been a guest before, and we look forward to many visits with him as the new dean of this school. As far as the number of students who are in public relations, do you have a ballpark figure on how many are at the Manship School?
That is a fantastic question that I don't know the answer to,
well,
Jim.
Is it about a third of the Manship students? I would imagine a substantial number are.
Right. I think we're I think we're the largest concentration at Manship right now.
The largest.
The yes. largest.
The largest.
Out of the advertising, polycom, and journalism.
Would you encourage students going to PR?
Oh, I would highly encourage it. I think, especially now that the Bateman competition is up and running and we hit the ground running on that, it's a great experience and a great opportunity to get real world experience.
And Amanda is now looking for work, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure you will do very well, as has your sister and your mother and father, of course.
Oh, thank you.
Are exceptional people. But the Fight for Five campaign, the Tigers with Purpose team, from the Manship School, ranked number one in the nation, beating out 83 other university teams from all over the USA. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. We're slated to hear from Carl Zimmer, New York Times science writer, when we return. He'll talk about Heredity. I mentioned Amanda Rabelais, but Heredity plays a very important factor in our lives. I think we knew it, but Carl Zimmer has some interesting reasons why. We'll talk about it when we return after this time out. Jim Inkster, thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Becca Dill is producing. And we're joined by Carl Zimmer, award-winning New York Times columnist and science writer, who is presenting a sweeping history of our understanding of heredity, a force that shapes human society and our future. In his new book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity, Carl Zimmer argues that we urgently need a new definition of heredity. Good morning, Carl.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to hear your distinctive voice. Why do we need a new definition for heredity in our world?
Well, I think that heredity is something that fascinates all of us, and it really shapes the way we think of our own identity. You know, we think about how our ancestors made us who we are, but these days we really are using language that kind of developed decades or centuries ago, and what scientists have been discovering about how heredity actually works really goes against some of our preconceived notions in a lot of different ways. So I think that as we are finding scientists at developing new ways to actually control heredity, we need to ask ourselves, well, what is it that we're concerned about, that we want to protect, that we want to alter? We have to understand heredity better to do that.
Why is heredity so important? It would seem that it's an easy answer, but it can be complex.
Sure. I think you just need to, think about how, you talk about heredity. We all do it. We will talk about, why we're tall or short. Oh, I got that from grandma. It's just all these things that make up who we are. We look to our ancestors to explain our makeup. But, the fact is that something like height, for example, is not based on, some simple gene that gets passed down, and if you inherit it or not, you're going to be tall or not. Scientists who study height, they can see that genes are really important to how tall we are, but actually there are literally thousands of genes that all can influence how tall we are. But each one, on average, might adjust somebody's height, a tiny fraction of an inch. So, even if something as simple as height turns out to be this really marvelous kind of universe of biological complexity, and so then if you go to other things like our personality and so on, well, then you're getting into really uncharted waters.
Now, you're the first journalist, Carl, I believe, to have your whole genome sequenced and analyzed by research scientists, and you share the results in your book. What are some of the most interesting findings?
One thing that I found fascinating was that I was nervous about what might turn up. That I kept thinking about genetic variations as being bad things, like, oh, they would find that I had a mutation that meant that I was at high risk of getting this disease or that disease. The fact is that we also carry mutations that can protect us. And it turns out that I just happen to have mutation that protects me very strongly from certain autoimmune diseases. And so that got me, learning about, well, what's going on in my immune system that protects me this way. And then I even learned that actually scientists have been studying this mutation in other people. I'm not the only person who has it. It's been inherited by lots of people. And they've actually developed a new kind of medicine that can help people with certain autoimmune diseases by basically kind of calming down their immune system so that they're not attacking themselves so much. So it's just fascinating to see that there's a connection between a mutation I didn't even know I had to a new drug that's just hitting the market.
You say that we as humans are gaining a burden of harmful mutations. How?
Well, paradoxically, we're getting this burden because we're getting better at taking care of ourselves. So if somebody was born, say, 10,000 years ago with juvenile diabetes, they would probably die before they had a chance to have children. So the mutations that they had that put them at risk of juvenile diabetes would disappear with them.
Interesting.
Well, today, someone with juvenile diabetes with good medical care will be able to grow up and be able to have children of their own, which is good. But they will pass down some of those genes to their children. So that will make their children maybe, at risk, sort of raise the general risk. And so scientists refer to this as our mutation load, that there's a load of these mutations that either cause, serious problems or just very, small risks. And overall, as we get better at keeping ourselves alive, we're going to be passing more of those mutations down to our offspring. So some scientists have said, well, maybe the mutation load is just going to keep increasing over, you know, 1,000 years. And what that would impact that would have in the future, we really just don't know yet. But it's a question that we can start to look at now that scientists can actually start to sequence, you know, DNA in millions of people. We can actually start to really get at whether a mutation load is something to worry about or not.
The book is She Has Her Mother's Laugh, from New York Times science writer Carl Zimmer. You believe that there is a new understanding of heredity that could help us address climate change. Now, some might think that would be a far stretch, but how would this work?
Well, in my book, I argue that we should look at how we inherit our things that shape our lives beyond just this gene or that. So there are lots of possible ways that you can inherit these things other than just through genes. And I talk a lot about culture. So we actually inherit culture along with our genes. You know, our parents teach us how to talk and how to do things, and we learn from them. And actually, you know, we humans are really unusual in that this kind of cultural learning is incredibly powerful in our species. And then one generation can build on what they've inherited from the previous one. And that has really, you know, that produced the agricultural revolution that led to the rise of civilization. And, you know, we, as we've gotten better at these forms of technology, we've also gotten better at putting carbon dioxide into the air as sort of a byproduct of our carbon-based civilization. Now we're confronting the impact of that, which is climate change. And, you know, future generations are going to inherit a warmer planet because of what we have been doing for the past couple centuries. So it might help us in terms of, you know, looking for a way forward, a solution to this climate problem, to think of it as a question of cultural heredity. How do we, if we want to tinker with the future of heredity, maybe we should, this is one way to be tinkering with it to make the world a better place for our descendants.
All right. A question from a listener about these ways that we can find out about our ancestry, the Ancestry.com and 23andMe. Are you a supporter of these vehicles that allow us to do this?
You know, I think you should look at them as sort of a starting point, not the final word. You know, we sometimes think that, oh, if we get our DNA test, it'll tell us everything about ourselves. The fact is that what these companies will do is they will sequence your DNA and then we'll look to what scientists are learning about our health or about our ancestry and try to give us the best interpretation they can. But if you go to different companies and try to find out your ancestry from them, giving them your DNA, you might end up with different percentages. And this is kind of disorienting to people. They say, like, well, how is that possible? And how can we trust any of this? Well, the fact is that the way you determine, you know, what percentage ancestry you have in some region of the world is just to compare your DNA to people in that part of the world. And so the more people are in these databases, the better they get. But it all comes down to these comparisons. So right now we're kind of in these, you know, early preliminary days where you're getting kind of a rough picture.
All right.
I like to think of it like with astronomy in the 1700s. You know, telescopes were not very good, but you could still see things through them, but a lot was blurry.
Another listener asks about men and women. Do we take our DNA? Well, we know what the DNA is, but for example, our looks, the way we look and act, do we take that more from our fathers or mothers, depending on our gender?
Well, you know, men are going to inherit a Y chromosome from their father, obviously, and so...
Okay. I think maybe we've lost Mr. Carl Zimmer, and we're heading for the finish line, and he's a fascinating gentleman, and hopefully we can bring him back soon. But his latest book is an interesting one indeed. She has her mother's laugh, the powers, perversions, and potential of heredity. And I know there were some people waiting to talk with Carl, and when we invite him back, certainly we'll afford the opportunity for you to interact with him. Thanks for listening today. For Becca Dill, I'm Jim Inkster. Back tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.